Hey, Phil, let go of my ego. Put aside the ego and embrace the moment.
Oh, for crying out loud. It's time for another midweek drive transcontinental adventure.
I was talking about waffles.
The showrunner is the lifeblood of a television show. It's a collaborative art form, but you still need that one central voice through which all these marvelous creative contributions are processed.
Being a showrunner is utterly consuming. You're editing and writing and doing 100 different things at once. It's draining. It's awful. I miss it terribly.
Showrunning is like painting a painting while writing a novel while doing your taxes.
It's a billion decisions a day.
It is at the same time the best and the worst job.
The shows have become much more cinematic in their scope and intention, and yet we're expected to deliver a show every 7 days.
Things are going well on your show if everybody's just a little annoyed with you.
Action!
Part of the job is being the broad shoulders of the show.
I am the king. Let's not forget that. But besides that, everybody's equal. Me and the little king, we broach no dissent.
You write something the first of the month, and then it's airing in a month. It's that urgency that's so exciting.
Wow, I have stories I want to tell. I'm going to tell them.
There's probably a certain rise in celebrity that goes along with the showrunner.
I'm just a writer, and then I turn on ABC, and there's my ugly, bald head. How the hell did this happen?
The age of showrunners being anonymous is over.
Do you know, I cannot believe that it was 2014 when Showrunners the movie actually launched. I mean, that quick calculation is nigh on 8 years, 8 English years. Since Dells Doyle's fantastic product actually emerged to the whole system. And it is still an absolutely iconic and essential must-watch if you want to have any insight in terms of the role of the showrunner and so on and so forth, either in the early decades of the 21st century or even before then. And as fate would have it, we're delighted to welcome back to the Midweek Drive for his first ever Zoomer. Effectively, it's the awesome director extraordinaire and writer, Des Doyle. Welcome, Des. How are you, sir?
Not too bad. Thank you very much, Alex. That was a wonderful intro. I'm going to have to pay you to do all of my intros from this point on.
Not at all. It's absolutely delightful to connect with your good self. And on a sort of series, which certainly, as far as the Midweek Drive has been concerned, has featured a number of showrunners in our way across the whole ether. Kenneth Johnson, of course, was a showrunner before it was probably fashionable to be a showrunner. To be referred to as Kenny, but obviously $6 Million Man, Bionic Woman, Incredible Hulk, Alien Nation, and so on. We spoke, of course, to Jamie Anderson frequently, who obviously Jerry Anderson, who we've also featured on the show, God rest his soul, also a showrunner from that perspective. Chloe Rose, in many ways, is a showrunner, but she's a singer-songwriter as well. So welcome, Chloe. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. And yeah, excited to speak to you, Des, as well. I mean, you've done loads of stuff. And yeah, your documentary on showrunners, I was watching the trailer on it, and it's so interesting, you know, behind the scenes and all the things you have to do to make it work. So yeah, can't wait to hear more about that.
And let's focus on that particular aspect, Des, because in Showrunners the movie, you cover everything from the Rizzolian Isles panicky showrunner in which she actually said, I can't believe I could be doing this for 6 or 7 years, to the awesomeness of Joss Whedon, of course, much beloved by Chloe Rose because of his Marvel Universe connection and the Avengers and so on, and his line with respect to that, although there are other issues with Joss that we may or may not go into, but that's another line entirely. And of course, I think it's fair to say, somewhat controversial, depending on your viewpoint, aspect of J.J. Abrams, I should say, and his particular aspect, easily confused, of course, with J.J. Abrams, who was, of course, the pilot in Forbidden Planet, but that's another line entirely. But his also approach. Des, how did you actually come up with this idea in the first place? Because, again, it was extraordinary from my own perspective. I was thinking, back in the day, and we're talking the 1980s here, before Chloe was even born, I actually did for my master's thesis an analysis of the effects of audience research on program makers. And then I was dealing with people like Jonathan Powell, head of drama at BBC, but also a creator of Angels, amongst other things. We also had John Nathan Turner, of course, who was probably a Doctor Who showrunner before it was fashionable to. So what gave you the idea to come up with, we need to have a documentary on these folk and what they do?
Well, I mean, from the time I was a kid, I kind of grew up watching tons of American television, because in Ireland, back in the 80s, 90s, there wasn't a lot of money to make their own original program, the network series. So there was an awful lot of kind of buying in American shows to watch. So I was kind of raised watching that stuff. And it was always markedly different from what you would see on BBC or our local channels and stuff. It was more money, you know, it was always beautiful California sunshine, that everything that was happening, and it all seemed very glamorous and stuff. And then when I started working in film, I started off working in the camera department as a trainee and kind of worked my way up over about 10 years. I got more and more fascinated with how things get made, you know, buying DVDs and listening to the making of documentaries and watching all the features on there about how the films and shows were made. Around the time that Lost came out, and I became obsessed with Lost, I was like one of those people that was on all the forums trying to work out what was going on. And
a bit like, you know, Chloe Rose and Stranger Things, I would imagine, then, basically.
Okay. It was a worldwide phenomenon. I mean, you would end up talking to people from Egypt and everything, like throwing ideas out there about Lost. But the interesting thing that started happening with that show was, because it was such a complicated, multi-layered story, the network didn't do the usual thing of putting the cast out there to do all the interviews. And so they actually started putting the showrunners out there, Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof. And they were doing these podcasts and they were doing these video things every week. And you could actually send questions into them and ask them about stuff. And then they started doing late night television in the US. And then they started doing their own books and stuff about it. I just became endlessly fascinated with what they were doing, what the job was. And at the same time, I was watching Ron Moore and Battlestar Galactica, and they were starting to do kind of behind the scenes, small video podcast kind of elements with David Icke about the making of the show. And then I started looking around for a documentary about showrunners, and I couldn't find one. So I kind of decided to make one, not knowing that that would consume the next 4 years of my life.
Well, as it says on the IMDb entry, of course, a documentary that explores the world of US television showrunners and the creative forces aligned around them, directed by Des Doyle. Written by Des Doyle, with, of course, J.J. Abrams, Kristen Bell, and David Boreanaz, who, again, do a whole variety of other aspects within that whole field. Obviously, times change. And again, Kenneth Johnson, who Chloe has also co-hosted a show with, he's somebody who, I mean, got a lot of time for Kenny, but he does say that, you know, there are so many producers now and so many different titles in terms of our routine, he tended to have to do the whole thing. So, do you think that sometimes showrunners sort of agonize too much? I mean, the biggest change, I suppose, basically, Des, has been since 2014 to 2022, has been the rise of streaming, Netflix, and the fall of Netflix, possibly, and a whole stack of other aspects that have come through in terms of that. So that, you know, series don't have to attract the kind of millions that actually they're. Again, we're referring to Joss Whedon's work on Firefly. It was one of the subjects of our recent Resonance Rewind, which Chloe was part of. And the whole essence of Firefly, as we know, why was it cancelled? It was cancelled because it only finished 97th in the Nielsen ratings. Arguably, there is a line that says that Firefly today would have had greater longevity.
I think it would. I think there were a number of unhelpful things that happened with Firefly in particular, because the show was aired initially out of order. So the pilot episode wasn't actually the first episode that was broadcast. So no one had a clue what was going on or who the characters were, or what the relationships were, like starting off with. And the pilot was
called Serenity, which was the same name as the movie that came up after the show. In any case, that's even more confusing.
Yeah. And then the show was constantly moved around the schedules. It wasn't supported really in terms of advertising, because I don't think Fox really understood the show that they were getting either. There seems to have been I remember Joss saying something about like some miscommunication between their understanding of the show they bought and the show that kind of actually ended up getting made. That actually happens from time to time, but it's never a good situation to kind of get
into. And going back to your documentary course, there is that sequence where you have the interview with Joss Whedon, and Joss is saying at the time, and you use a graphic that says he's working on the last season of Buffy, the fourth season of Angel, and the first season of Firefly.
Yeah.
And clearly, that I think, quick calculation, that meant he basically was responsible in that year for 56 shows or 56 hours of broadcast television, which is a phenomenal amount. And yet, actually, he didn't drop the ball. They all worked very well. But again, was there any sense that, because I would have thought that presumably with respect to Firefly, there would have been expectation it would have been picked up for a second season as Dollhouse was?
Firefly was a more expensive show to make than Dollhouse was. And also, Fox were in a position where they had a kind of a talent deal with Eliza Dushku around the time that Dollhouse was being made as well. So the situations were a little different. I think they thought a second season of Dollhouse was a less risky bet, potentially.
And let's face it, Des, Dollhouse is simply Joe 90 switched into a different version. You know, it's what it's all about, really. Gerry Anderson leads the way on this aspect.
You know what they say, Alex, there are no new ideas. There are only reinterpretations of existing ideas. So, but I mean, I did enjoy Dollhouse for what it was. And Stephen DeKnight, who's in the documentary as well, did a lot of work on Dollhouse as well, because he was kind of came through the school of kind of Joss Whedon as a showrunner and writer, as did many other people over the years.
I mean, this is, of course, that you also feature Jane Espenson and the work that she actually put together and how she sort of develops within that whole thing. Let's open it up, though. I mean, Chloe, from your own point of view, do you take notice of the Duffer brothers when they actually are producing the joys of Stranger Things? Are you concerned about the production thing? Do sort of, or is it just a case of you just like to watch the product?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I love to know, like, you know, what's been done behind the scenes, what, you know, how they've got the locations where they've scouted for and, you know, the effects. And, you know, I always say, like, no matter what production you're in or whether it's like a performance or whatever, without the makeup artist, without the costume designer, without, you know, the runner, that's you know, trying to help people out, you know, it wouldn't be a success. And everybody is vital, and it is so important that you like, what's the word, you're respectful of everybody, because if it wants for them, definitely. Yeah. And I mean, you've seen all this. I'd love to know more, Des, like what's like your favorite moment on Showrunner when you were directing that? What was like one of your favorite moments doing that?
Maybe first time that we went to visit Bad Robot, the offices there in Santa Monica. And I think it's okay to say this because I think it's well known at this stage. Maybe it wasn't at the time, but Bad Robot actually disguised their office as a different company because they had so many people kind of showing up, and they pretended it was a typewriter repair company. But JJ went to the length of actually having vans outside with typewriter repair on it, and any of the staff that came in and to wear typewriter repair t-shirts, to the point where people actually brought typewriters to get them repaired. And
I mean, Des, that's as bad as Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin having to go through a tailor's shop to get the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement. I mean, you know, that's just, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, for goodness sakes.
Well, I kind of liked it. It kind of ties in with his personality, I think, a little bit, and the way he likes to do things. The first day we actually went there, in the reception area for Bad Robot, they have kind of a display of all the props and replicas and costumes and stuff from all the different films and TV shows they've made. And JJ was kind of talking us through some of them. And I discovered at the bottom of the shelf, there was a board game for HR Puffin Stuff, which is a show my dad used to love back in the day.
Star Jack Wild, exactly.
And JJ started to explain to me how the guys who created the show were completely out of their minds on drugs all the time. And if you actually go back...
Hence the title, HR Puffin Stuff.
Yeah, it's in the title. But I didn't get now. That at the time. But if I watch it now, I kind of go, yes, these people were stoned out of their minds the whole time making the show.
HR Puffin Stuff, push your brain when things get rough. HR Puffin Stuff,
can't do a little, cause you can't do enough.
Once upon a summertime, just a dream from yesterday, a boy and his magic golden flute heard a boat from off the bay.
Come and play with me, Jimmy, come and play with me, and I will take you on a trip far across the sea.
Belonged to a cookie or witch who had in mind the flute to snitch.
From her broom broom in the skies, she watched her plans materialize. She waved her wand, the beautiful boat was gone. The skies grew dark, the sea grew rough, and the boat sailed on and on and on and on and on and on.
But Muffin Stuff was watching too and knew exactly what to do. He saw the witch's bold attack, and as the boy was fighting back,
he called his rescue racer crew, as often they'd rehearsed, and off to save the boy they flew.
But who would get there first?
But now the boy had washed ashore, Puff arrived to save the day, which made the witch so mad and sore, she shook her fist and screamed away. HR Puff and Stuff, who's your friend when things get rough? HR Puff and Stuff, can't do a little cause you can't do enough. HR Puff and Stuff, he's your friend when things get rough. HR Puff and Stuff, can't do a little cause you can't do enough.
You got someone who loves you, you got someone who cares, you got someone who'll fix you up if ever you need repairs. You got someone who'll take the time sudden your prayers. I got you, got everybody. You got someone who cares by the name of HR Puff and Stuff. Where'd you go when things get rough? HR Puff and Stuff. You can't do a little cause you can't do enough.
Sure hope so.
But yeah, that whole time, I suppose, that first tour and meeting JJ for the first time and stuff, that was pretty cool, because when we actually went into the room that we're going to film with him, they actually had seen some Star Trek Into Darkness up on the screen that they were doing some post-production work on, and the guys had to very hurriedly try and take them down. They weren't expecting us to kind of walk in at the moment.
Oh, Des, all you should have said was come and that would have ended it all, yeah. Really, you know.
No, absolutely. I actually just rewatched Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan last week with my 11-year-old niece Grace. It's their first time going through the Star Trek movies, so she absolutely loved it. So
the original and that version, I think, is inevitably better than Into Darkness, which is a different line entirely. So we'll draw a line over that, because let's face it, JJ Abrams' protege Alex Kurtzman has a lot of flack and continues to get a lot of flack from a lot of Trek folk. I think, to be fair, Star Trek The New Voyages, or I should say Star Trek Strange New Worlds, is probably finally managing to kind of restore some of the sense of Trekness that was actually there. However, that's for another discussion with Gary Graham.
I would just say, Alex, everyone should, even if you didn't like Picard Seasons 1 and 2, I think you will love Picard Season 3. It's a completely different beast. Terry Metalis, who's been the showrunner on it, is not just a lifelong Star Trek fan, but he's been a writer on Star Trek in the past as well, and he's written some of the best Star Trek graphic novels. It is a love letter to Next Generation Season 3, and I think people will be delighted with it.
Well, That's good news, Des, and good to hear, because clearly the last time Star Trek fans were given a love letter, they got the final episode of Enterprise, and that didn't end very well either. But never mind. We'll be speaking to Gary Graham and his role of Inspector of Ambassador Saval on another time and in the not-too-distant future. Chloe, as an observant soul, you may have noticed that Des is actually wearing a T-shirt on which he has those particular letters displayed. Ooh. Now, again, you're far too young to actually remember the official series UFO, but it will be serving as a resonance rewind thing. We'll be working through Supreme Headquarters Alien Defense Organization, if memory serves, is what the thing's there. And I want to talk a little bit about that, Des, but also to one side, I would have thought surely this has got to be one of your next future projects, no pun intended. Isn't it high time we actually had a TV version of the original graphic novel that emerged in the Power Comics of the 1960s with Alf, Bart and Coz, of course, started off as The Missing Link and became Johnny Future? When are you going to do it, Des? When are you going to sign up the rights for Johnny Future, get in touch with Rebellion and actually produce the first and arguably best British superhero called Johnny Future?
There are many, many Rebellion books that I would love to turn into films and TV shows, but considering the difficulty that Duncan has been having with Rogue Trooper, even I'm not sure.
Forget Rogue Trooper and genetically modified infantry people. Go for Johnny Future. You've got the start of the incredible the Missing Link, and then it moves into the into Johnny Future world. It's fantastic. And it's what happens when you go into a nuclear reactor. You can accelerate all sorts of things.
There definitely is a gap there somewhere in the market, especially on, say, Disney Plus UK or Amazon Prime UK or wherever, for a UK-based superhero or story. They don't seem to be too pushed to go down that road for some reason, because there's so much American content in that space they can use. But I'd be interested in watching one.
Well,
of those.
There you go. And you won't have the battles with Disney that Captain Britain would actually give you, for instance. So, you know, Brian Braddock is a different sort of kettle of fish entirely. Chloe, you're a keen Marvel watcher when you're not doing your fantastic singer-songwriting. And of course, a reminder that Golden Sun is going to be released very, very shortly, your latest awesome single and track. Are you still committed to Marvel? I mean, She-Hulk, preceded, of course, by Miss Marvel, preceded, of course, by all the...
Oh, yes. I'm Miss Marvel at the moment as well. That's being watched at this... Well, not at this very moment, but over the past few days.
And what are your thoughts on this? Because there's been a lot of, again, mixed sort of lines on this whole system. Are you enjoying the process? Or is it a case of sometimes you think Disney is going too woke? And I'll bring this up with Des in a few moments. Is it a case of... Oh dear, you know, look what's happening with respect to going too woke in the situation.
I don't know. I'm loving it right now. I'm loving all these sort of series they're coming out with all the superheroes. I mean, WandaVision was insane. Once I started watching that, I was like, wow, this is great. I'm just loving it. Like, you know, keep them coming basically all the way. Doctor Strange is just my favorite character. I just wanted to say. And there you go. Too much excitement, Des. That's what it is. When we talk about Marvel, I'm off. I'm gone.
I hear you. I understand it for sure.
I mean, my point basically being, and I just thought I'd put up another Kenny Johnson photograph, a sandwich between Lou Ferrigno and the late, great Bill Bixby, of course. The thing that wasn't really prevalent, I mean, obviously the internet was around when you shot Showrunners in 2014. But the level of vitriol that's being poured out, certainly by various YouTubers, various quote-unquote influencers, who would actually say that Marvel's lost the plot, that Disney's gone too woke, that, I mean, the latest thing I noticed, you've got Robin of Sherwood there, and there's going to be a reimagining of Robin, R-O-B-Y-N, with her hood, and it'll be a female Robin Hood, etc. Do you feel as though there is a confusion over that? I mean, again, we were speaking very shortly to Gary Graham, who had the lead in a series called Alien Nation. And Alien Nation, also produced by Kenneth Johnson, for me, said a whole stack of things about intolerance in society and so on, just as Star Trek did, without necessarily having to hammer it over the viewer's mindsets. And arguably, again, Doctor Who, well-known British institution, could be going that way as well. What are your thoughts, Des? Share with us.
Sorry, that's to me, is it? Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, are people too overtly sensitive, or is it a case of sometimes you need a balance between an entertaining show which people can watch, and then any messages that can be developed can be seen as being allegories or metaphors, as opposed to this is what it's all about?
Yeah, I kind of think the word woke has kind of become very misused by a lot of people, to be honest with you. Woke really means, or used to mean, that like you are aware of
past tense of waking up.
Exist, right? So people have been doing things to try and rectify the inequalities and the biases. And I think that's absolutely fair thing to do. I love Miss Marvel. I thought that was a fantastic show. Actually educational while I was watching, because I didn't know that much about, you know, Muslim culture or religion or the history of Pakistan. I mean, they pack a lot into that show. And I thought Iman Vellani was great in the title role. So like in terms of, or even I just finished watching Sandman, there was a lot of grief online about Sandman, about race swapping and gender swapping characters and stuff. And it's all irrelevant, because you're talking about characters that are anthropomorphizations of like, you know, intangible subjects and feelings and emotions. And anyway, so I don't really understand that either. I do think there are some shows that have replaced key storytelling with trying to make political points. And I think they've done that unsuccessfully. But I think those shows are in the minority overall. And I don't really feel that, like, I don't really feel like, you know, men are being replaced in television storytelling, or that straight people are being replaced in television storytelling. I do think storytelling in general is becoming, it's evolving at a very fast rate at the moment to try and find out really what works best for the way we're consuming content at the moment, because the way that people watch television has fundamentally changed, and the way people engage with television. And it's weird, like, that we seem to be cycling back to the old is actually new again, because we're going back to advertising, and we're going back to weekly drop, and we're going back to ad breaks and stuff. It's really kind of interesting. But for me personally, I'm not in a constant state of aggrievement about television being too woke or whatever. Like, I mean, there are, you know, I don't think you need to gender swap or race swap every character. But again, for something like Doctor Who, it that makes perfect sense to me that you try something different again. Like Jodie was kind of groundbreaking. And for me, the saddest kind of thing about Jodie's Doctor Who run is I never thought the stories lived up to her potential. I don't think Chris Chibnall did a great job there particularly. So I'll be curious to see what Russell does, because obviously he's come back out of love for the subject matter. Obviously, he's got a lot of ideas about what he wants to do with it in as Doctor Who could exist now. But yeah, that would kind of be my position on, to be honest.
It's one that will continue to grow and evolve and doubtless take its own sort of route forward. So Showrunners, awesome movie, but as we said, 8 years ago. Are we looking to Showrunners too? Because clearly there's an awful lot of things you could actually look for that. Or is it a case of, no, I want to actually remake Gerry Anderson's UFO and make it less sexist?
I don't know. I get asked about Showrunners too about once a month. No offense. No, we're actually gearing up to do something different in the US next year. We're hopefully, what can I say about this without breaking my NDA?
You don't have to say anything, Des. You know, we love you on the show, so you don't have to say anything. You just sort of say, shh, it's all.
Okay.
Non-disclosure agreements are in place for a reason. And yeah, Disney occasionally tunes into the show, so what the hell?
but it won't be a feature doc, it'll be a multi-part doc, and it is television-based again. I think I can say that much. So I'm looking, COVID has really, like, thrown us in a loop for the last year or two. In, you know, the logistics of trying to film in the US and getting, you know, agreements from everybody, because a lot of the people that you want to deal with are locked into their own COVID protocols and all the different shows and stuff that they're on and whatever. So it's challenging, but hopefully as things you know, hopefully continue to improve a little bit.
The good news with respect to COVID, Des, is unlike back in the day when you made your debut on the Midweek Drive, we can now see you. We can engage in all sorts of wonderful things on top of you. And I could even go further. And as Chloe knows, I could actually embrace my inner raccoon in a hoodie just to actually demonstrate the importance of that on a beach. You know, I mean, for me, this is just so much more important in terms of getting the message out of there. And helping the whole radio thing work. Anyway, Chloe.
Have you ever survived without filters?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes.
Chloe, what other questions would you like to put to the Doylemeister?
I like that, the Doylemeister. I would like to ask the Doylemeister, what inspired you? Obviously, the passion was there from the beginning, but what inspired you? What made you think, right, I want to be a writer, director, that is my goal, that's what I'm going to do? You know, what made you turn to that field of work?
I suppose I feel I went to the best film school that you could ever go to, which is actually working on films and TV shows for years and watching other directors and writers work.
Yeah.
So you learn a lot of the things that are good things to do, and you learn a lot of things that are bad things to do at no cost to yourself. But I kind of always wanted to direct, even when I was in college studying film and stuff, wanted to, but I kind of thought that understanding camera was an important tool to have, like if you wanted to be a director. And then I kind of enjoyed that so much and loved the people that I was working with so much that kind of ran longer than I thought it would. But when I got an opportunity to pitch something to do myself, I jumped at it. And yeah, I mean, it's you do spend an awful lot more time in development as a writer and director than I'm used to. And development hell is a very well-named state of mind and place, because, it can be challenging sometimes trying to get stuff funded and get stuff off the ground and backed and whatever. But at the same time, the fact that anyone will give you or give me money to go off and do things that I want to do creatively is fantastic. So, I'll take that for as long.
Richly deserved as well, Des. Richly deserved. We start the campaign now to ensure things are worked through. Des, we heard, musically speaking, the HR Puffin Stuff theme earlier. Do you have any other music that you'd like to listen to chill out or to kind of keep your own thing going? Or would you like us to just basically do a whole montage of Gerry Anderson themes?
Gerry Anderson themes are always good. I listen to a huge amount of like film score music, like people like Thomas Newman, James Newton Howard, James Horner, like all of that stuff is fantastic.
So let's force the whole thing in. James Newton Howard, which one would you like us to go for and from which movie?
James Horner from Star Trek 2. That would be awesome.
The Wrath of Khan.
Wrath of Khan.
Thank you. frontier. These are the continuing voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Your ongoing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life forms and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Well, we are continuing our little discussion with Des Doyle, a showrunner, director, of course. And I mean, the other question, basically, Des, is would you ever fancy being a showrunner yourself? I mean, you've seen a lot of these guys work. You've seen the stresses that they've been under, everything from Sons of Anarchy right the way through to Risley and Isles, right the way through to J.J. Abrams, of course, and Damon Lindelof and the Fringe thing, etc. Well, are there any sort of moments where you sort of think, yeah, I'd like to actually have that fun of being the total coordinator of the whole thing? Because I have to say, Des, the actual eating seemed to be very unhealthy. There were a lot of kind of unhealthy snacks being consumed. I didn't see a great deal of evidence of any of the showrunners actually having what I would call wholesome, nutritious food in the discussions that you filmed.
No, I was back in some writers' rooms in LA in 2018 and 2019, because we brought some writers over from Ireland to spend some time with these guys, and things hadn't improved at all. There was still tons of candy and donuts and chocolate. It's the sugar rush to kind of keep people going through the day. It has changed.
Yeah, it's a false economy, Des. You know, sugar rush today, diabetes tomorrow. That's not going to help anybody.
No, well, it has changed a little bit now that so many writers' rooms have kind of moved to being virtual and online and stuff and whatever. So people are maybe being a little healthier in that regard. But I used to always say no to being a showrunner because it was too much work. But I've actually spent the last year or so creating a show over here. And if we sold it, I would love to become the showrunner on it. But I would very much want to be in the tradition of what they call the old donkey situation, which is by you've got a really super experienced producer that's on your shoulder the whole time, kind of going, don't do that, don't do this, make sure we don't go over a budget on this, something like that, because I know some stuff, but I certainly don't know remotely enough to kind of just be let go off on my own. And one of the slight problems that we have at the moment in the world is there's too many shows and not enough experienced showrunners. So there are an awful lot of people that are being upgraded who aren't quite ready really for that upgrade and are getting into a little bit of trouble along the way. And the other unfortunate thing that's happened is the ladder, the system that used to be there where people would go in on a show as a staff writer and slowly move their way up the producer ranks, that's unfortunately disappearing because under the streaming model, what happens is you put a room together, the showrunner puts a room together, it runs for 3 months or 6 months. They write all the episodes and then everybody goes except the showrunner. So only the showrunner gets to learn or gets to spend any time on the show. Whereas on a network show, the way they still make them on network, the room can run for 9 months. Everyone gets on set for their episode. They get into the edit. They get to spend time on notes calls. They get an overview of the budget for their episodes. And a lot of that kind of institutional knowledge that's been passed down is being lost. So there's a whole new generation of writers coming up that aren't really getting the opportunities that the writers before them did. And that's actually going to start generating some real shortfalls going forward, unfortunately.
We were talking recently to the ace writer, George Mann, who just returned from this year's San Diego Comic-Con event. It's the first live one for quite some time. Are you a regular San Diego attendee?
I was. I haven't been in about 3-4 years now, but obviously pandemic was a bit of a problem as well, but I'm hoping to resume. Everyone I knew was at San Diego Comic-Con this year, and I was just like living vicariously there through social media, all the videos and photos.
Well,
and stuff.
I did notice, Des, that there were a lot of people who said, but where's Des Doyle? And it just wasn't the same without you. So clearly that's the bottom line. I mean, you know.
Well, the one thing I do hold on to is some friends of mine went to the Entertainment Weekly party and they met Tom Sturridge, who plays the Sandman in the Netflix show, and we're talking to him. And seemingly he said, where's Des Doyle? So
I'm not going to share this with you if it was based on false premises. You know, it's baseline with that. Richard Edwards couldn't make it either. But then again, he's freelance, but so it goes. He's the editor of SFX magazine. I will point out, of course, that in terms of showrunners that we've been talking about in some detail, it's probably going to be the best $9.99 you can ever spend via Amazon Prime if you want to buy the entire movie. There we are. So it's available there via Amazon Prime. So just go for it. You could rent it for $3.95, but don't rent it. You buy it. You know, it's there. You know, in virtual sense. Go for that whole thing. That's the end of the plug. Des, how can people actually follow you? Have you got your own TikTok account as yet? What's the sort of way in which people who are listening to this can say, we want to give Des Doyle stacks of cash?
Yeah, contact me on social media with all offers gratefully accepted. I'm on Twitter as Des Doyle Films, on Instagram as Des Doyle Films. I am not on TikTok. I don't have the bottle to get on TikTok and start making videos for TikTok, unfortunately.
It could be a step too far.
Probably a little bit of a step too far for me at this stage. But, you know, maybe I'll have to. I know my niece is trying to drive me there at the moment or whatever, so we'll see what happens going forward. But,
Or maybe a TikTok video of your niece actually driving you to take part in a TikTok video, which kind of goes into a lovely sort of curly lost sort of situation.
That would go viral considering she's 11. So, yeah, we might get into some trouble for that one. All right.
Yeah, but the Irish always have different ways of dealing with the world. Sure enough, we do. We know that. Chloe, would you like to put those last two questions to Des at present?
Absolutely. So have you had a lovely Zoomer with us today?
Yes, it's been a ton of fun. Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, gosh, we've loved it. And will you be returning soon?
In
the future?
If you guys want me to return soon, yeah, I'd be delighted to return soon.
I'm thinking, Chloe, that Des might be ideal to join us on our regular weekly slot, Resonance Rewind, in which we look at a piece of classic television. As I was saying, Des, we recently considered Firefly. We look at a single episode, usually, or a single movie and so on from that point of view, and just kind of share our thoughts on how well it's either continued to resonate or in instances like Chloe, it might be the first time they've ever seen it. I mean, for instance, Alien Nation, Chloe, season one, episode one, Fountain of Youth. It's going to be the first time you've ever seen that. And we get a chance to speak to Gary Graham. You know, it's great. Maybe you might like to join us for one of those weekly shows. And I'll send you the list, because we've basically got the list up until basically 2024 now, in terms of the things that you could actually say, I quite fancy that one. I'll put my sort of thing into that sort of area. So would you join us for one of those?
Yeah, no, I look forward to taking a look. All right, yeah. Nothing I love more than watching classic
well TV. Exactly. And of course, I would hold you to that Johnny Future movie. It needs to be made. It needs an Irish director, showrunner at the helm, and I think you should definitely go for it, because he's vastly underrated. I know, Chloe, you won't be familiar with Johnny Future, but seriously, it was actually Power Comics was the British press imprint which carried with a number of Marvel comic strips in the 1960s, including Thor, the X-Men, and Doctor Strange, and they used the brand Power Comics. But the only original two or three pages was actually Johnny Future, which is where the whole thing is actually there. So make the movie, Des. It needs to be done.
I will try, because I'd actually never heard of the character until 2018 put the book out, and I absolutely love the book. So yeah.
Well, you didn't get that. You're probably too young to remember it, basically. When I was over in Ireland in 1968-69, Sligo was packed full of fantastic, terrific, and all sorts of other wonderful things.
Wow, okay. A little bit
before your time. It's okay. It's a youngster. What the hey? Des Doyle, hopefully, will return. Take care now.
All right, thanks.
So, care, it's something which we may not like to think about, but clearly can indeed occur in a whole variety of ways. And when you bear in mind that the average pension pot is only enough to pay for 2.5 years of care, and the average stay in a care home could be 4 years, there are clearly issues here in terms of a cost of care crisis. And to talk us through some of the possible options that you can actually choose and select and maybe consider adopting, we're delighted to welcome the Managing Director at Taking Care, of course, that's Steve Gates. How are you, Steve?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. Now, some of these findings are quite sobering. I mean, care home residents typically spend at least 4 years in care, costing individuals on average £113,000 to £161,000. Those are significant figures, which maybe people don't realise unless they've won the lottery, could massively impact how they could actually sort of be taken care of as well. So, Steve, to start off with, in terms of the survey for this side of things, do you feel that people literally are just not thinking enough about the possibility of needing care?
So, Alex, I think it's exactly the point that you made just now. I think it's not something that we want to think about. Certainly it's not something we think about it far enough in advance, probably to start saving for. In terms of the area that your listeners are in, care home costs are mid-range. So we see more expensive care home costs, London and the Southeast. We see slightly cheaper care home costs in the Northwest. But you are absolutely right. It's a significant investment. If you are using the equity in your home, as many people do in order to pay for care home costs, that can be up to 60% of the equity that people have in their home to cover those 4 years that they're in care.
Now, in an ideal world, I think most people would actually prefer to stay away from care homes and stay in their own particular environments. And you've actually sort of come up with a list of tips and advice that can possibly help families with elderly relatives to actually help them stay safe in their home for longer for a much more affordable costs.
Absolutely. I think you are totally correct that people want to stay in their own homes, in their own communities as well. So we've got a range of advice in terms of both home alterations, home adaptions, to make sure that people are as safe and secure as they can be in their own home. Some of that is about handrails, grab rails, making sure the lighting's good, making sure the mats are non-slip, making sure slippers, which are one of the key reasons for a fall, are actually renewed regularly, making sure things like bathrooms are safe and secure as well. So there are some things that you can do in order to prevent a fall, because a fall is often, with an older adult, something that precedes a stay in hospital and may potentially be the start of their journey into that type of care home setting. So there's a look at the house, look at the home environment. And then equally, we've seen a real surge in interest in terms of personal alarms, technology-enabled care, which again ensures that if somebody does fall, then they can get support and care really, really quickly. And we draw the analogy that in heart attacks, we all know about the golden hour, which is that if you can intervene the hour after a heart attack, the health outcomes are massively better. And absolutely the same is true of a fall. So the sooner somebody can be lifted back off the floor, made safe, made secure, is really, really important. So we're seeing a real increase in terms of interest in personal alarms. And that's from, if you like, the end customer, what we call the loved one, the older adult, but also from their families as well, because it's about ensuring that the older adult feels safe and secure and their families feel that mum or dad are safe and secure in their own home.
Certainly, looking at the ways in which digital aspects can provide greater support are fairly critical. Actually, even sort of monitoring can actually help, and with a support system around, that can certainly be sort of vital, I would have thought, in terms of actually ensuring that there is a support network. And presumably, in the absence of family, you could also consider look to to friends or colleagues or other folk who might possibly be able to help in the event of obviously people living alone with their family not necessarily being able to help them?
No, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. So if I think about one of the classic records that we would hold for our loved one customers, it will normally have on there a range of contact numbers, some of them that we can then ring in the event that a fall happens. Some of them are friends, some of them are neighbours, almost certainly there will be family members in there as well. So what that means is that when we're monitoring an individual 24/7, if something does happen, one, our team can triage the situation and understand whether or not we need to go to emergency services straight away, or there might be other local options. And again, if you look at your listeners' area, average ambulance wait times for a fall where someone hasn't injured themselves is about 11 and a half hours. So clearly that sort of friend network, that neighbor network, that family network, absolutely crucial in terms of getting that support in as quickly as possible.
For people who just tuned in, although they sort of want to find out more details about this particular aspect, where can people go to find out more about these suggestions taken care of, put into place?
So if you visit our website, taking.care, all sorts of information, all sorts of articles about supporting older adults, all there. Also online, you can do a free, what we call a falls risk score, which is 14 questions. Either mum or dad can answer them, or you can answer on behalf of mum or dad. That will identify their risk of falling from 1 to 5. And that can also guide you to the right type of both technology that will help them based on their risk of falling, but also will help you think about some of the adaptations to the home as well.
Well, Steve, you certainly provided food for thought and key things to bear in mind there. For the moment, though, Steve Gates, Managing Director at Taking Care. Be well, be safe, and continue the good work.
Thank you, Alex.